It's Thursday, April 4th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca, and this is journalist Helen Lewis.
This is journalist Mike Pesca.
Confusingly, the clip of her that I chose was her introducing me. We could go around in circles, but I shan't. I was the main character, and I know they say when it comes to the internet, don't be the main character, but I was the main character. I'm going to say, I'll call myself the main character of episode 3 of the BBC series, Helen Lewis Has Left the Chat.
It's February the 15th, 2021, the height of the pandemic. Snow is blanketing the eastern seaboard, and he's helping his parents. It's a national holiday in America, and he's meant to be having the day off. So he's trying to ignore the work chat that keeps pinging on his phone.
So, you know, I'm maybe checking in. Maybe 45 minutes or hours go by before I even check in.
What Mike doesn't know is that he really should be checking his messages.
I in no way sensed the stakes. I didn't even think that it was this all-time fight.
At this point, Mike works for the American magazine Slate, hosting their daily news podcast, The Gist. At this point,
it might seem like a story of a good son, a dutiful son, a shoveling son, but it is so much more than that. This is, I have to say, the most straightforward, but also interesting, well-done account of this thing that happened to me and that happened to The Gist, which brought me here today in front of you as a Peachfish production enterprise. It was about a discussion I had. You should listen if you're interested in this discussion I had a few years ago, but I do have to tell you, one thing, and this thing is my fault, one thing annoyed me about myself. See if you can pick it up here.
I didn't sense this was anything that could change my life, let alone change tomorrow.
But everything was about to change for Mike. And Mike thinks it's all down to one little app on his phone.
Flappy Bird. The website was Flappy Bird. No, it wasn't. It was Slack. But that's not the annoying thing. Here is what I said. I said, you heard me just say it, I didn't think it would change my life, let alone change tomorrow. That should be reversed. That's how you structure that sentiment. I didn't think it would change tomorrow, let alone my life. And if I had said it once, that'd be fine. I mean, I did say it once in real life. I said it to her and didn't even notice my mistake. It's not how cognition and linguistics generally works. You say something wrong, you don't notice it until you hear it later. But in this case, I heard it and heard it and heard it again. Not because I'm such a glutton for punishment, but because they used it as the tease cut. And they used it, I think, in the trailer. And they used it early in the episode to tell you what's going to happen later in the episode. Oh, my God. And I've worked on podcasts, on these kind of podcasts. And things like that do not go unnoticed. People in the production of this podcast definitely discuss that very phrase. In-house, at the BBC, they were discussing my backwards phrase, saying, why did he have to say it backwards? If only he hadn't been so daft. Well, we'll just have to go with it. And his stupid backwards phrase, I guess people will think maybe in America they say the phrase that way. I wouldn't be surprised if a producer, there was this nice producer guy named Tom, literally went home one night cursing the order of my idiom. I know how these things go. Now, no one is more upset than my misspeaking than I, but I say this to my friends at the BBC, I will make it up to you. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but for the rest of our lives and someday. On the show today, well, Chicago station WBEZ laid off 14 in their podcast unit. This comes after WNYC, the New York station, laid off 20, mostly podcasters. The DC station WAMU, same thing. They pretty much dissolved a major chunk of their operations. Colorado Public Broadcasting happened in LA, happened to NPR National, everywhere. Why? Well, I'm going to say something in the spiel that they're not saying publicly in the world of NPR. Something that seems obvious, but goes like this. The programming did not appeal to the audience, and I do think there are specific reasons for that. But first, Emily Blout teaches about the intersection of politics and technology at Georgetown. She's the author of the book Media and Power in Modern Iran. And on the Liberal Patriot Substack, she recently wrote a piece titled The Disturbing Rise of Strategic Antisemitism. Emily Blout up next. This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters, and hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I've been reading the work of Emily Blout in The Liberal Patriot. It's a blog I enjoy. Her latest piece is called The Disturbing Rise of Strategic Anti-Semitism. We'll define terms and get into the meaning. I should tell you that Professor Blout is a professor at the Center for Jewish Civilization at Georgetown University. She's the author of Media and Power in Modern Iran, Mass Communication Ideology in the State. She joins me now on The Gist. Welcome to The Gist.
Thank you.
There was a phrase in your piece about anti-Semitism as a means of state power that talked about soft power. And normally when we hear soft power, when I hear soft power, I think, oh, that's preferable to kinetic military force. Soft power is the way diplomats utilize their tools so that people don't die. Yet in this context, it was pretty insidious. So tell me, if you can, about using anti-Semitism as a means of soft power.
Yeah, I think actually, first we should define our terms. That's a really important question, but we need to really talk about what anti-Semitism is. So I use the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition, and I'm going to quote it now. It's anti-Semitism is a certain perception of Jews, which may be expressed as hatred towards Jews. Rhetorical and physical manifestations of anti-Semitism are directly toward Jewish or non-Jewish individuals and or their property, and toward Jewish community institutions and religious facilities. So just thinking about how it shows up, it shows up most often in, for instance, Holocaust denial or distortion. So saying it didn't happen or it wasn't intentional or that even Jews invented it to create an impression of victimhood in many other ways. And then it also shows up in conspiracy narratives. So, you know, Jews are responsible for, you know, fill in the blank events, or Jews control the media or banks. And then, of course, you have just the regular tropes, right? So deicide, Jesus killed Christ, blood libel, Jews drink the blood of Christian children. And then finally, contemporary anti-Zionism, which is something we can go into later if you want.
Yeah, that definition, I also see it on State Department papers. I see it attributed to the European Monitoring Center on Racism and Xenophobia. So it is a standard, or one of the many different subtlety, slightly differing, but it is a standard definition that's applied by many organizations.
Yeah, that's right. And it's really important that we just agree on terms. So I've been talking about and thinking about this idea of strategic anti-Semitism. And I define that as the deployment of the rhetoric of anti-Semitism to support a nation's strategic interests. So in the context of this war, right, some countries see the war as an opportunity to advance their national agenda in the region, but also vis-a-vis America and other enemies. And they're using strategic anti-Semitism to do that. So let me take the example of Iran. So Iran's leaders are almost certainly, and I would say 100% actually, anti-Semitic, right? But they're also politicians. So you're seeing right now Tehran using anti-Semitism to advance its interests economically in the region, and then also as this part of a longer-term effort to build its power and influence in the region. And that's been tough for Iran historically, right? So you would say that Saudi Arabia is really the regional hegemon at this point, but Iran has always seen itself as that and mm-hmm. has been attempting to realize that vision of itself. And that means it has to bridge historical and religious divides between the Arabs and the Persians, right? The Sunnis and the Shia, in order to establish that predominance that it's seeking and that leadership of the Muslim world. So examples of doing this through strategic anti-Semitism, you know, there's plenty full as pennies, right? Recently, you're like just at the communications front, you're looking at the way that, you know, the Iranian leadership celebrated the Hamas victory while denying he had nothing to do with it. But, you know, on October 30th, and here's really that pisses me off, it coerced its Jewish minority into staging a series of anti-Israel made-for-TV rallies in, you know, 5 different cities. It launched influence operations, actually doing the still, standing up fake organizations, Israeli social media groups that obviously don't exist. It's disseminating Hamas propaganda in Israel through fake accounts. And then, of course, like state media is just overtly, without apologies, circulating cartoons and memes, casting Israel as bloodthirsty and pushing lies about atrocities with anti-Semitic frames.
Yeah.
So that's just one way Iran is doing it, but you're also seeing this with China. And I think this is a more interesting example.
Is because we would expect Iran to do it. We would expect the Quds network or the Hezbollah-controlled media to do it. But tell me about China. What are they doing? Are they more subtle?
Exactly. You know, it's not alone. It's really using this, the opportunity of the war, to tap into the well of anti-Semitism around the world, right? But it's interesting in that, you know, interesting, it's kind of scary that it's using social media in this way. So TikTok is a big problem. You know, some, you know, according to some, and, you know, reports and surveys, 67% of American teens are using TikTok. I think it's probably a little higher. But so China has these algorithms within TikTok that's creating echo chambers. It's putting fabricated accounts of Israeli atrocities into really, you know, heavy circulation. And, you know, it's encouraging young Americans to take sides, you know, on the conflict with little or no understanding or even interest in the history and complexity of the conflict.
What role does Al Jazeera play in cementing the narrative of what's going on there?
That's also a really good point. So Al Jazeera is the source of the major source of information within Gaza and the West Bank. And as I said again, the survey that came out, you know, 80 to 90% of Gazans don't believe this attack happened to different levels, but certainly don't see the images of people, the accounts of what happened, the atrocities committed. They have no understanding of this, and it's totally it is omitted by Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera is also funded by Qatar, who's an incredibly important middleman in the different negotiations. And I have talked to representatives from that country, and they say that there's a firewall between the Qatari government and Al Jazeera. But, you know, look at that as you may. I would be a little bit cynical about that. But it is, again, the source of a lot of Gazans and West Bankers information.
Yeah, firewall is one thing, but knowing where your money comes from is another, and the hiring practices of the organization and what greater interests you're serving. And there have been noted examples of Al Jazeera
being shut down, or certain stories on Al Jazeera being shut down. So a couple things about Al Jazeera that I think are important. We get Al Jazeera America. That's one thing. The people in the Middle East will have other versions of Al Jazeera. How do they differ from what we see to what they would see?
Totally. I, on October 7, sat down. I'm a media person, so I'm interested in this stuff. I sat down. I was live streaming Al Jazeera Arabic, the main Al Jazeera, and then the English Al Jazeera. And there were, you know, some similarities, but there really was, when you get down to it, two different pictures. I was astounded, floored. I don't know what other way to say it, but Al Jazeera was running footage of the, you know, the celebrations of the attack, accounts of the attack before any other news network. And it was very much a propagandist depiction of what happened. You remember that there was a tank. There's this iconic image of a tank and people celebrating around it. They had that footage before anyone else. And Al Jazeera English also had that. But Al Jazeera English was, you know, packaging it in a much more, what seemed to be, objective way, and much more made for English audiences. Whereas Al Jazeera Arabic was just celebrating it flagrantly. I mean, there was these montages which just showed a rebel resistance force doing these things.
So an update is, I don't know if you know of NewsGuard. It's Steve Brill's company that gives letter grades and sort of a version of the Good Housekeeping seal of approval to different websites. And the point is, they sell their services to companies. Companies know what's a credible site to advertise on and what's not. So these letter grades are useful in terms of informing companies what you could trust and what are you putting your ads on. So they'll give failing grades to the obvious propaganda outlets, and they'll give different grades to, you know, Fox and the New York Post and the Washington Post. Al Jazeera has just been downgraded by NewsGuard to proceed with caution. The trust score from January 2021 through November 2023 has dropped from an 82 to a 52. So you could consider 52 a failing grade. So I don't know if you knew that, but it is people who watch Al Jazeera for a living and have no real dog in the fight except for fairness have adjudicated them to be an unfair network.
That's fantastic.
And so I think, though, how it shows up, even if we know this, when I do a search of information about Gaza, I can't help but have Al Jazeera come up as the second or third most prominent search result. And so I can, if I know what NewsGuard's score is or how they put together news, I can mentally discount them. But there's also the effect of, you just see a headline, you're scrolling past, you don't consider the source, and you take it on faith, or you take it as just another piece of information in your information matrix, and it gets lodged in there. And this is one way that propaganda works, is it not?
Absolutely. Just seeing it and being, it's called priming. You have to be, you know, exposed to a message in a different ways again and again and again. And whether or not you click on that, you're consuming it, you're taking it in.
How do you think the news media, either the sources that you've looked at, even Western sources, you talk about TikTok, take any media you want, how did they fairly, unfairly, what did they get wrong about the genocide charges in the International Court of Justice?
I mean, there's so many different outlets and, you know, approaches to this. I think the genocide claim was specious and it was dangerous, but it's not new. Israel has been, you know, accused of genocide for many, many, many years. And it's the same kind of thing that, you know, what happens when you accuse Israel of being a Nazis, right? Committing the Holocaust against Palestinians. It is, by definition, anti-Semitic. It's subjecting a nation that has not done everything perfectly to any extent to this unfair standard. And then also taking the very trauma that Jews endured and were exposed to and flipping on its head and then accusing Israel of that deed. You know, genocide, the term was invented by a Jew. I think it's a Polish lawyer. And the convention on genocide at the UN was a, you know, factor, a major factor, I would say driving factor, as a response to the Holocaust. So it was deeply troubling. It was not, however, surprising.
Yes, invented by Raphael Lemkin. But my question is, so I understand your perspective on it, a specious charge. But the news media, I think, can't cover it as such, just full stop. They have to, well, you don't always have to both sides everything, but let's hear out what this genocide charge is. And then I think they need to, in order to best orient their audience, they have to put into perspective what's new about these charges. They perhaps have to talk about how even the Israeli who was serving on the ICJ agreed or signed on to two of the six charges. So my question is, not in your perfect world, but how do you judge, say, the New York Times or CNN in covering these genocide charges? Do you think they should just come out strongly with the specious charges of genocide, or should they cover it more in a way that allows listeners and viewers to come to informed conclusions on their own?
I mean, the job of these outlets that we trust, you know, these outlets, New York Times, Washington Post, they uphold the journalistic standards that I think every outlet should aspire to. You know, they're not always right, but they do try to cover the news with, you know, objectively. I think there was a problem. There is a problem of context. There's not enough historical, you know, contextual information to really allow the reader to make it's their own, you know, their own, you know, evaluations of what's going on here and why this claim and charge is coming up at this point, and really who's behind it.
Yeah, it makes me uncomfortable to flat out say this charge of genocide is anti-Semitism. It can be motivated by anti-Semitism, but a lot of people, I keep coming back to Barack, who clearly are not anti-Semitic, think that there's something there. And I worry that if you claim everything is anti-Semitism, then you degrade the credibility when there clearly is anti-Semitism in play.
I think that's a fair point.
So I wanted to ask you about one of your areas of expertise, Iran. Do you think they're good at what they do? Do you think their propagandistic efforts have any effect outside the people who are just inside their network and being denied the reality of the outside?
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of mixed on this. You know, it's the same kind of thing with cyber. They have been, you know, just promoting their cyber capabilities for decades now. And for decades, they haven't had the kind of cyber capabilities we see of America, China, Russia, of any of the big powers that they get grouped into. But that said, recently, cyber operations have become, you know, an expertise of Iran. Iran has certainly, you know, boosted, you know, the complexity, the targeted nature of the cyber operations. And I think that's kind of the same with its information operations. It's learning. It's learning from Russia. You know, Russia is, you know, the pinnacle of brilliance, I would say, on information operations. So it's getting better. But I don't think you should look at information operations or even cyber operations, you know, independently. We have to think about how they work together. So, you know, people talk about different disinformation, you know, but you also need to think about just the larger paradigm that Iran is operating on. And we really need to appreciate it. And that's, you know, this world where asymmetric warfare, terrorism, conventional warfare, cyber and information operations all work together. And that is what Iran is doing. It's using proxies. It's using information warfare. It's using cyber. It's using conventional weapons, or at least providing conventional weapons in a way that I've seen is troubling and very effective to a point.
What about citizens of the world who live in democracies who do think October 7th happened and actually believe it happened to the extent it really did happen, but now look at the images of suffering in Gaza, dead babies, famine-like conditions, and that will change their opinion. So putting aside, they do believe in October 7th, but they're just appalled by what's happened since. Is that going to be the determinant of the prosecution of this war?
I think there's a truth in that. I think, though, you also need to connect it to anti-Semitism. You know, anti-Semitism is deeply rooted. This just didn't come up around the war. It's deeply ingrained. And so these pre-existing frames of Jews and Jews as Jews being Israelis and Israeli being Jews is also impacting how things are coming out and how, you know, we're going to view this war 10 years from now and how people view Jews writ large. And that's very dangerous, very, very dangerous.
Was Israeli leadership caught unawares by that phenomenon?
Israeli leadership, in my sense, you know, and I can't speak for all of them, don't give a damn about that. You know, this is just about wiping out Hamas, freeing the hostages, restoring deterrence. And, you know, I see, you know, both people I've talked to, and again, I can't generalize, but it's really about that mission rather than the repercussions or the PR problem.
But they should care about it because that will constrain their ability to, everything you said, wipe out Hamas and, yeah, remake the Gaza Strip.
I think that's fair, too.
Emily L. Blout is a media scholar, historian, a Georgetown University faculty member at the Center for Jewish Civilization. She is the author of the book Media and Power in Modern Iran, Mass Communication Ideology in the State, and she writes for The Liberal Patriot. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now the spiel, audio carnage at NPR. There are so many layoffs and cancellations occurring in the world of public media. It doesn't make me happy. Friends of mine have lost their jobs. And quite selfishly, podcasts I love will no longer be available for listening. That happened, a once-loved podcast that is no more. That happened and played out a couple of years ago. And the podcast was Invisibilia. It was hosted by one of the greatest radio reporters I've ever worked with, Elise Spiegel, veteran of This American Life, alongside Lulu Miller, who is also this kind of radio genius with a background from Radiolab. By season two, the show had hit its stride, adding Hannah Rosen, who wasn't an audio person then, but is one now, a great one, hosting the Atlantic's podcast. Invisibilia was everything I loved about audio storytelling and the NPR way of tackling an issue, engaging an audience, and bringing abstract concepts to life.
What do you think, Lulu? Do you think that you can teach cheerful? Welcome to the second season of Invisibilia. I'm Elise Spiegel.
And I'm Lulu Miller.
Invisibilia is a show about all of the invisible forces that shape human behavior, our emotions, our beliefs,
our expectations.
And our question today is, can you take an emotional norm and transform it?
Right. Are these large, invisible, seemingly intractable
things? The original gang broke up. This was, or their success, was near the dawn of the podcast boom. They were all lured away. Today, Lulu's hosting her old show, Radiolab, and Elise is back at This American Life. Retreat to quality, I guess. But what happened to Invisibilia since, I think, is instructive. New hosts took over, Yahweh Shaw and Kia Miaka Natisse, and a new sensibility emerged. In the past, the illumination that Invisibilia provided was mostly on issues of the psychological, sometimes the sociological. They did stories about race, violence, perspectives, but it was always grounded in scholarship, or at least I would say there was some interesting study or finding the host could point to. Under the new host, things changed, and change could be good, but then things veered off track. So Invisibilia had an episode about a black woman who set up a GoFundMe-type account for any white people who were feeling guilty. The ethical dimensions of this weren't, again, to my ear, weren't fully interrogated, as they say. It was just this fun kind of thing. They did a story about an introverted, to the point of paralysis, stand-up comic. And this comic's therapist was a former dominatrix. This, by the way, is a great premise for a movie or a sitcom or a podcast story. But the story they did on the show, a show that was once grounded in science, was just kind of confusing about everything. Then in 2021, they ran a story about trains, about slow trains. The idea was we all exist in such a fast-twitch, attention-laden environment. It might be soothing to put on a program where a camera just traces the landscape as seen from the side of a slow-moving train. By the way, that actual show is popular in Norway. So here's a clip of the Invisibilia reporter talking to Eric Schatz, a TV producer who had pitched the idea of the slow-moving train to U.S. executives.
His idea of driving across part of California. Sure, it could be a beautiful meditation on our landscape, kind of like a visual version of Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land. But not everybody hears that song or sees America's landscape the same way, right? Here's Fred Turner, the media historian again.
The idea of driving across the American landscape inside a vehicle and marveling and feeling like it was ours, that's pretty hard in a place where just 150 years ago, European settlers wiped out, you know, several million Native Americans, where slavery occurred. You know, those kinds of things make that celebration of the land very difficult.
This show is not about that. It's not about what's right or wrong with our country. This is not the show for that. You go to watch CNN or MSNBC or Fox News if you want to fight about that.
I kept pressing the point. What you film is a political decision. Eric pressed back.
Like, just chill out and watch. Take it in. Calm down. Turn down the temperature. Look at this fucking Zen moment in the middle of nothing.
I said that was, you know, a privileged perspective to take.
Invisibilia, like much of NPR, and maybe much of progressive America, had gone insane. NPR and public radio, long stymied by an audience that's whiter and older than their workforce, and an audience that is whiter and older than NPR's ideal for their audience, began to program differently. Too many inside of public radio, this was long overdue. A debate broke out in newsrooms, not just public radio newsrooms, everywhere, about objectivity. Leadership was publicly called out on past failures of such issues as diversification. Just like everywhere else in media and society, the aims and opinions of lower-level staffers began to flood the traditional studied reasonableness, you might say, overly cautious studiousness that the network was known for. All across public radio, they began to redefine who the programming was for. I, as a listener, as a former employee, understood this. I heard a lot the explanation, you know, Mike, not everything is for you. Not everything needs to be for a 40 or 50-something-year-old straight white person. Fair. Eventually, it began to feel like not everything needs to be for you went from an explanation to something of a mission statement. Here's a program that was greenlit at the time called Louder Than a Riot. Season one was about rap music and incarceration. NPR.org describes the second season this way, quote, season two of Louder Than a Riot examines who hip-hop marginalizes, how misogynoir, the specific racist misogyny against black women, is embedded into the fabric of the culture that we love. And that is exactly what the program delivered.
It's me, Chameleon, and two older white men just having a blast that night, running around the streets of Miami.
The four of them were getting turned at the same club Aida and Chameleon had just been filming the show at a few days earlier and was set to film at again. You could say they were getting ratchet for the sake of research. Aida stepped away for a second to go to the bathroom, and apparently the club staff had a problem with that.
I'm trying to use one of the bathrooms, and they're like, this is for the employees, ma'am. You can't pee here. But I'm already in the stall peeing, so that's crazy.
And she made me mad because she walked in on my girl peeing. I'm like, bitch, what is you doing?
I'm calling the cops. Get out. You're going to jail.
I'm like,
get
girl, you
here.
Call whoever you want to call.
This is NPR? Well, it was. And you know what? It wasn't a mistake. It was a huge break from what NPR had sounded like and what the rest of NPR pretty much still sounds like, which many within NPR regarded as what it sounded like was exactly the problem. I think that show, Louder Than a Riot, by the way, I think it's well done. If you judge a show on the basis of does it have a vision, does it ably achieve that vision, Louder Than a Riot does. But it's such a break with what NPR had always been that management and staff should have known that it was very unlikely to find a large audience. And as these things go, it cost a lot. NPR is a brand that doesn't complement the programming of Louder Than a Riot. Again, you could say that's right, but it should. Except it doesn't. My point is, it doesn't. It was unlikely that this show was going to become a hit. That doesn't mean it shouldn't have been made. It just means that it should have been made with considerations given to the uphill climb that it faced, given how different it was from everything else NPR had been. I mean, think about, you have this brand, NPR as a brand means something. You want to move or shift or nudge the brand, but how do you do that? Well, maybe you could use the fact that you have a giant terrestrial audience and a giant podcast audience to point to other programming. This is basically the only way that podcast discovery works. So there on NPR, it's, well, thank you, Stuart Eisenstadt, former Undersecretary of the Treasury in the Carter administration. And now, here's a clip from a new NPR podcast you might enjoy.
Man, Tuesday was so Atlanta off jump. Because here's the thing about the trap capital. Everybody's got a side hustle. It ain't just the doughboys and the dancers. Even the real estate agents got a trap mentality.
That is the epitome of programming not made for me. And by the way, I think I have some perspective on not for me programming on NPR because for years I delivered sports to the NPR audience who mostly would be inclined to say sports, not for me. So I knew ways to do this and I knew that I could use some jargon, some argot, right? I could probably say the high pick and roll. I don't know that I'd want to, but I definitely couldn't say, well, you know, you got to watch the back screens when you're in a matchup zone. And this isn't terribly complex verbiage for the sports fan. Watch the NCAA tournament games this weekend. Over 10 million people will be watching, and an announcer will definitely say something about back screens and matchup zones. But the classic way of doing things on NPR was to meet the audience halfway, part of the way. Louder Than a Riot and a few other shows with it eschewed that formula, which is fine, but again, management and staff had to know that that would make the show's success quite unlikely. And even with shows like with Invisibilia, where none of the words or phrases or concepts would be foreign to an NPR listener, there is just this assumption of shared ideology rather than just make your case when your case relies so much on fairly new ideas, ways of thinking, ways of speaking, and assumptions. All of this trying new things, trying different things, radical, somewhat radical breaks, or very radical breaks from what had come before. That's okay. That's what innovation demands, right? And it is public radio. They make decisions all the time saying, okay, this might challenge the audience. This might not be a huge audience hit, but we think it's worth it artistically or journalistically. We'll let the success of, say, a Planet Money pay for two or three or four of these passion projects. Only NPR found itself paying for 5 or 10 or 15 of them. And when I say NPR, I mean the same is true for all of public radio. In the past few months, big public radio stations in Chicago, New York, Colorado, Washington, D.C. have fired staff, have canceled podcasts. There are many reasons, but you'd have to cite the programming choices and programming changes at the network and at the stations as contributing to the lack of appeal to the audience. I'm not sure they will have to credit the lack of appeal. But if you had the leeway to really do a self-examination of why the programming failed to connect, I would think you'd have to at least consider the content. I know there are so many excuses out there. A lot of the excuses are valid. I read a lot of stories about how NPR listening has been sadly affected, plunged after the pandemic, the drive time radio audience, and the idea is that the same kind of unplugging as happened on broadcast TV is happening with radio listening. And that did happen. NPR's listenership is down by 15 or 20% since 2018 or 2019. But you know what? Commercial radio hasn't been affected that way. AM and FM radio is actually not down much, if anything at all. And the Sean Hannity or finance guy Dave Ramsey or Screecher Mark Levin, they're still holding their rather huge audiences. In a way, NPR and Morning Edition and All Things Considered aren't. Same with their podcasts. I mean, you want to argue that, oh, NPR listeners just shifted to podcast. Well, NPR radio listenership went from a weekly average of 29 million in 2019 to 24 million in the year 2022, the last year for figures. And in 2019, according to NPR's annual report, podcast listeners were at 11.2 million a week. They actually increased in the next year. But last year for which there's a report, it's down to 8 million a week. They're leaving NPR, public radio, is leaving listeners behind. And I do think in part it's because they were programming to the audience they wanted, which is fine and aspirational, but at the same time they ignored, or in some cases even disdained, the audience they had. But audience was never their number one goal. It seems crazy, but I'll give you this quote, which isn't rare and wasn't uttered once and then backtracked. This is what John Lansing, then the NPR chief executive, believed. Their number one goal was, quote, to reach a younger, more diverse audience and to expand NPR into parts of the American community that have otherwise not really found maybe so much resonance with NPR. This is their North Star, not my description. John Lansing would always describe their DEI initiatives as their North Star. Their DEI officer says in interviews, this is our North Star. And on that, I think they've been successful. For the 2021 fiscal year, their hirings were only 22% white people. Frequently, public radio spokespeople will point out that even though the overall audience has declined, the audience that's left is more diverse than it was before. Left unsaid is the fact that you can achieve that effect by merely losing lots of white people as listeners without actually gaining people of color. When NPR announced the layoffs of the staffs of Invisibilia, Louder Than a Bomb, and a couple other podcasts, and 84 total employees, Bloomberg's Ashley Carman reported that tensions boiled over. During an all-staff meeting, John Lansing, who was CEO at the time, asked upset employees to, quote, turn down the rhetoric and not call executives out by name in an all-hands with hundreds of attendees. Quote, I would never, ever, on your worst day, call you out by name in a meeting with 827 people, he said. Carmen goes on to report some employees interpreted this as tone policing and felt uncomfortable. They immediately took to Zoom and called Lansing's response racist and out of line. Another staff member dropped a link to a segment from NPR's Code Switch titled When Civility is Used as a Cudgel Against People of Color. Civility is a weapon wielded by the powerful, one person wrote, according to the screenshots of the chat viewed by Bloomberg. This meeting has made me more afraid for the future of public media than any conversation I have had in a very long time, wrote another. Well, I'm afraid that public radio is in a very lamentable and possibly non-correctable position. I don't know that they'll ever be able to course correct given the culture of public radio. The excuses are built right in. The priorities are for something other than audience growth. And the conception is that critiques like mine either aren't in good faith or I'm sure will be interpreted as a desire to get back to the older, boring, white person way of programming. I just ask public radio, NPR, to consider the idea that if the message stated or unstated is that, hey, not everything needs to be for you, sooner rather than later, a lot of listeners or former listeners, when asked why they no longer listen, will answer, I felt like it wasn't for me. And that's it for today's show. Corey Wara produces The Gist. Joel Patterson keeps his nose in all aspects of production as our senior producer. Michelle Pesca is in charge of special projects for Peachfish Productions. To advertise, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Oompru, jeepru, doopru, thanks for listening.